then move on to the last item of the day, which is item 20, keeping in mind that I have 1, 2, 3 speaker cards for that item. And I will close now speaker cards on this item. So please introduce the item. And
this is item 20, the executive officer's report. I'll first call your attention to the supplemental sheet included you should have received for this item. It's an update, a further update on the Montecito debris flow. The water quality certification table is there. I'm not going to talk about it unless you have questions. I'm going to move on to the Montecito mud flow item. So this item provides you with background on the tragic Montecito debris flow event and our role in the response effort. We've also provided, I mentioned, the supplemental sheet, and I've sent you several email communications, I believe, on this as well. So I want to note that the debris flow happened in multiple watersheds on the South Coast. Those less familiar with the South Coast, they're very short, very steep watersheds on the South Coast, and I believe it was more than half a dozen watersheds that were impacted by the rain and subsequent flooding events. Our primary role was one of facilitation rather than our more traditional regulator role, as agencies tried to work through initial search and rescue operations and just moving debris such that they could get in to the affected area. We worked with the Santa Barbara County Flood Control District and Montecito Sanitary District, and to a lesser degree, Caltrans, Army Corps, US EPA, Cal EPA, and county and state offices of emergency services, as well as the Division of Drinking Water and UC Santa Barbara. We've migrated now back towards a move, not a completed move, but a move back towards our more typical regulatory function. In that capacity, we issued a 401 certification to the Flood Control District. Included in that were requirements for, among other things, grain size testing, chemical testing of the material that they were disposing on the Goleta and Carpinteria beaches. And Harvey can provide maybe a little more detailed look into what's coming back from that monitoring, although it's still pretty early in that cycle. And then I think I'll ask Harvey to maybe reflect on Montecito's wastewater treatment plant and how it's coming back. So the community was essentially shut down by and large for an extended period, and the wastewater flows were virtually non-existent, and yet you have to keep a wastewater treatment plant alive, and so it needs carbon into the system, and now that the community is back online, we can see how it's functioning and how the Monterey Sanitary District was able to keep the system alive while there were no inflows. We're continuing with our migration, as I mentioned, towards the more traditional regulatory role, and looking at the end of disposal on beaches in the near future with respect to Flood Control District. I also want to acknowledge, just for a frame of reference, that all of the material that has been dealt with by permitting and disposal to date represents a tiny fraction of the material in the debris flow, on the order of 5%. The remaining 90 to 95% is on private properties and will have to be dealt with ultimately. And there's going to need to be strategies, discussions between agencies on how to deal with this. And that's not insignificant at all. And then I was just going to turn your attention just in a more general sense before we go to the slides and the video. Towards a discussion of emergency preparedness. At WQCC, we talked about the Santa Rosa fire and being more nimble in our response to emergencies. And after that, the Thomas fire came along. And even before the Thomas fire was out, the debris flow event happened. They're literally simultaneously going on. And at a recent collection of EOs and the executive director of the State Water Board, we realized this is our norm. It's not our new norm. Actually, it's been going on for quite a number of years. Fires in Santa Barbara County are actually a fairly frequent thing, about every 3 years, 5 years. Yeah, and they're substantial fires, too. I think in the last staff report, I made mention of the fact that of the top 20 fires in the state, 35 to 50% of them have a piece in the Central Coast region. So we have that distinction, unfortunately. So the idea is we can do a better job of emergency planning for emergency response, be it in the Montecito kind of episode where it's not affecting us directly, but we have to facilitate actions, or in the Santa Rosa experience where it is affecting our office and our operations as an agency, and how do we respond to that. So the executive officers tasked a working group to start developing checklists and a plan for how we would respond to both of those two scenarios I just laid out. And that's in motion. Taya Tryon right now is our tasked representative to that task force. I think with that, I'm going to turn towards Harvey and say, let's slides and the video.
Harvey Packard. So I've got an 11-minute video, if the board wants to watch that, kind of a summary of the event, and about 20 photographs and a map. So we can start with the video. Cal OES,
Office of Emergency Services.
It was what some called apocalyptic.
Oh my God, Mom!
Although they knew it was coming, many people still got swept away.
They were trapped, and unfortunately, many people were killed.
Hundreds of rescuers still searching for the missing.
We have had a number of significant rescues and a number of rescues today.
How did this happen? We've got answers from experts. And what you should be doing before the next storm hits. That's coming up on this edition of Inside Look.
Hi, I'm Brian May in the State Operations Center at Cal OES headquarters, where they are continuing to coordinate mutual aid efforts as hundreds of rescuers continue search and recovery efforts after the mudslides in the Santa Barbara area. Hundreds of first responders from all across the state continue to search for those still missing. Santa Barbara County officials on Wednesday said this is still very much a search and rescue operation.
There are several factors that go into determining how long a victim will be viable, and all of those factors, including air temperature, soil temperature, weather conditions, and the like, will be evaluated before we move into the recovery mode.
With still so many people missing, if you or a loved one are safe, you can let your family and friends know that you're safe, and that can bring a great deal of peace of mind. You can register yourself safe and well on the American Red Cross website at safeandwellcommunityos.org. Here at the State Operations Center, they're coordinating over two dozen mutual aid teams, from Swiftwater urban search and rescue teams to fire engine strike teams, like what you would see at the fires. That's nearly 600 personnel deployed. And understand, the conditions that these search and rescue teams are in are among the toughest you can imagine.
These guys are worn out. You know, they're doing long hours. They're not going to quit until every rescue's been performed. But one of the unique things about that mud is the weight and the amount of effort it takes to move through it. So it's not, you can't just dig a hole in the ground now to find somebody, because that's all going to want to cave in on you. It's just taxing. It's heavy. It's wet. It's everything everybody hates. It's muddy. It's wet. It's heavy. It's long hours. It's cold. And it just exhausts the crews out there.
In addition to the search and rescue efforts, there is also a massive cleanup effort taking place. That river that you see is actually Highway 101 in Santa Barbara County. This portion of 101 closed until early next week. Sean Boyd is in Santa Barbara with more.
Yeah, we're here in Santa Barbara at the Highway 101 overpass of Olive Mill Road. I don't think you've ever seen Highway 101 that empty before. Maybe that dirty, maybe not. But let's take a look at the north side of this overpass. This is where the lowest point of the highway is. It's where everything is congregated, all the debris, the mud. But not only is the debris removal operation in full swing, it's also simultaneously a search and rescue mission. An excavator normally assigned to dig and remove material is now being mission tasked as a people mover. Members of the L.A. County Urban Search and Rescue Team are suiting up and climbing aboard the bucket at the end of this 60-foot arm to comb every inch of this half-mile stretch of Highway 101, looking for any signs of life. 72 hours into the massive mudslide that's devastated Montecito and Santa Barbara, there's still the possibility and hope that someone will be found alive. Meanwhile, heavy equipment is scooping, dumping, and scooping again, and again, in a concerted cycle with the goal of removing every gallon of mud from Highway 101.
There are some sections of the highway that were flooded up to 2 feet.
It's an operation jointly coordinated by Cal OES and led by Caltrans. And time is of the essence.
This is the lifeline between L.A. and the Central Coast. 95,000 vehicles a day use this section.
Earlier, Cal OES Director Mark Ghilarducci, along with Santa Barbara's Sheriff, National Guard, the CHP, and FEMA, got an aerial and ground tour of the path of destruction.
Right now, as we verified the need for search and rescue personnel over the period of the next few days, and we also got a really good sense of the complexity of the debris clearance operation that's going to be required here.
Those SAR teams conducted primary searches using specialized drone and helicopter flyovers, and those are now being supplemented by this. The dozer dump dance will continue day and night, with trucks often resembling planes lined up on the runway at LAX, waiting their turn to move ahead. Monday, January 15th is the goal they've now set to complete this enormous challenge.
So we'll be out here 24/7 with our operation to clean up this highway, and then we need to check for damage.
Boy, the activity going on around town is incredible. The work that is going in to clean up the mud and get these roads open and safe for travel is incredible. And not only do the people who live here and have been negatively impacted by these floods and mudslides love the firefighters, so do we here at Cal OES. Back to you.
Sean, thanks. Search and rescue teams from across the state had searched about 75% of the affected area as of Thursday. The storms had claimed 17 lives, and officials fear that number could climb. That's why hundreds are still involved in the search and rescue operation. After touring the area by both ground and air, the director of Cal OES left with two key takeaways.
People who get warnings to evacuate need to evacuate. There are cases where people did not evacuate, did not heed the warnings. They were trapped, and unfortunately, many people were killed. And the second thing is that these types of events, we don't see them that often here in California, but they present a series of challenges in being able to figure out how to get resources into an area that's completely covered in 5, 10, 15 feet of mud.
So the question many of you may still have is, how did this happen? The wet weather that went through Southern California didn't seem bad enough to cause this much damage and destruction. With more on how this happened, here's Jonathan Goodell.
We are here in the State Operations Center where coordinated efforts are ongoing in response to the Southern California storms. Up to 5 inches of rain fell in Santa Barbara County alone within the last 24 to 48 hours. And to talk more about the storms, we brought in Courtney Obergefell from the National Weather Service. And Courtney, this felt like just any other winter storm. What was significant about it, and what was different this time?
So it was like a normal winter storm in terms of amounts and coming off the ocean. But what was different this time is we had wildfire burn scars from this fall and winter, and we had a lot of very heavy rainfall that fell in a matter of hours, causing the mudslides.
So two terms we've heard a lot about in the last 2 days, mudslides and debris flow. What are some of the differences between the two of them?
So a debris flow is basically just a bigger mudslide. So a mudslide, you get rain and water moving down a hill, bringing mud with it. A debris flow happens after a wildfire, and so there's nothing left to soak up the rain on the hillsides. So it can bring down trees, boulders, rocks, anything in its path.
So it's still early in winter. What are some of the lessons learned maybe we've learned from this event and also moving forward, some tips?
Well, people who live near burn areas, we advise them to be ready to evacuate in a minute's notice. Do you know where you're going? Do you know what you're taking with you? Do you know how to get in contact with your family? And also to heed those instructions from local officials should they ask you to evacuate.
Absolutely, Courtney. Thank you for the advice. The rain has stopped for now, but there is still work to be done in the field and still a lot of work to be done here at the State Operations Center.
Here's why areas that burn in wildfires can face such severe flood risk when it rains so soon afterwards. During a wildfire, the burning plants release gas, and that gas permeates into the soil, causing the roots to weaken. The gas then cools and solidifies, forming a wax-like layer at the surface. Unable to permeate the ground, the rain then begins to saturate and weaken the topsoil above that waxy layer. As more rain falls, chunks of topsoil break loose and slide down the slope. Rocks, trees, and mud flow freely and can exceed 35 miles an hour. Left behind, a thick, water-resistant layer that can last for years based on the intensity of the fire. As you heard earlier, even with the increased threat of debris flows and mudslides, some people did not heed evacuation warnings when the heavy rains began. We want to take this time to remind you, if you are in a burned area and you're advised to leave, do so.
We try and use the strongest possible language we can to make people understand that they need to leave their homes, gather the valuables that they need, paperwork, licenses, things of that nature that are irreplaceable, and then get out and recognize that your life and the lives of your family are more important than your properties.
Again, please listen to and follow evacuation orders. If you are safe or a loved one safe after the mudslides, mark yourself safe on the Red Cross website. And if you'd like more information on a local level, you can go to the County of Santa Barbara's website. That's countyofsb.org. For all of us at Cal OES, I'm Brian May. Thanks for watching.
Visit our online newsroom at oesnews.com to learn more about this.
This shows a map of the affected area. You zoom in here, you can see the various creeks that are affected. Red are destroyed structures, yellow major damage, yellow is minor damage. So I don't know if we need to spend a lot of time on it, but you can see the stream courses just by the number of homes that are damaged in each of those little areas. And I guess we can send this link to board members if you're interested in taking a look at it yourself. It's still active. This is live on the internet right now. Okay. And then what we thought we'd do is show some photographs that we took on our inspection of Montecito. So straight to that, we can go through them quickly. Feel free to ask any questions.
This was on January 23rd, so it's about 2 weeks after the event when we went there. We're trying to be conscientious with respect to the flood control district who provided the tour too, because they're literally swamped at that point in time. Bonnie.
I'm showing this picture because it's looking back away from the ocean, but it shows the burn area in the background. See, the first ridge here is burned, but also behind it, this tall ridge, that's all been burned just a couple weeks before it rained. And these watersheds start at the very top of this ridge and congregate the water and the debris. You can see they're very large watersheds. It's not just a small little area. Some of these things are big and contribute a very large amount of rain, of storm flow and sediment. So if you turn 180 degrees from this spot, you'll see the beach. This is Carpinteria, where the county was taking materials from the slough, which had been inundated with debris, and was moving it over to the beach. This is the same operation, but up in Goleta, at the Goleta Beach State or County Park. This material had been screened already at the Ventura County Fairgrounds, so they were trying to bring only clean material, no debris, no trash, no rocks or vegetation. They were walking it and removing any bits of trash they could find. Disposal area is still active, but in decreased use. The Corps of Engineers permit expires on February 20th, and it doesn't look like they're going to ask for an extension of that. So this will be done by the next couple weeks. Then we got some pictures of some of the areas that we saw. This is looking upstream from our road. You can see that there's a lot of deposition here. And then you can see where there was a lot of erosion. Actually, this stream bed had already been cleared by the county. What I found interesting is some of the flooding wasn't caused just by overtopping of the banks. When the debris flows came down, they'd hit these bridges and the culverts and immediately plug them up just really, really quickly. And so the water level and the mud level would rise until it spilled onto the road, and the road would start to act as the conduit, and from the road it would spill into the neighborhoods. So just because you weren't living right next to a stream didn't mean you were safe. It could affect you all over the... See that? Here's the bridge, the edge of the bridge there, and you can see the mud level as it backed up and came up over that bridge way out down here. This is one of the in-stream sediment basins on, I think, Montecito Creek. See the mud level back here. The county and the Corps had already cleaned this one out. Oop, upside down. Same, a view of the same place. And again, the county came through and cleaned out some of these stream channels immediately because they feared another rain event. But upstream of here and in other places, there's still a lot of stream channel that needs to be cleared. That's actually two cars that somehow got connected and tumbled down the mud flow and barely recognizable now. There were houses in this area that are just gone. Mud line. It's not a two-tone paint job. That's a mud line on the house. Dang. I'd made previously. You can see a house foundation right here. Nothing left but the foundation. Next to a stream channel. And that's, you know, 10, 15 feet above the bottom of the channel. Driveway of a house. Back to the beginning. That's it. Just an idea, electronics show in some small way the damage that we saw. You can't really experience it unless you see it, like I'm sure Jane and maybe Jeff have seen, but it was quite a sobering experience to see it firsthand. Yeah, yeah.
And there's a great photograph that appeared in one of the, either the News Press or News Hawk, of a boulder so massive that they had to take jackhammers to it.
Break it.
Just to break it down so that dump trucks could move the pieces away. I mean, you could see all the boulders that are in these photographs. That's really the remarkable thing to me.
The force
came down.
That, yeah.
This watershed was taking out structures.
There was a 40-foot fish impediment. I think it was on Romero or Cold Springs, and that was completely blown out, the entire concrete block. So if there's ever fish, there's no impediment. But it was extremely devastating, and apart from just the boulders, the destruction.
Naomi.
So I was pretty close to this with Albion and Caltrans, and one of the interesting things was that they couldn't use explosives to make those rocks smaller because of the gas mains. And so they actually had to use an explosive gel where they would drill down in the rocks and put the gel, and then the next day the gels would expand, and then they could come back and make them smaller and smaller.
Harvey, one thing I'm really interested in is any kind of water soil testing that was mm-hmm. done on any of the materials that were, you know, cleaned, quote unquote, but then deposited on beaches. And I think maybe you have some information about.
Yeah, I can expand on that a little bit. The county continues to do their surf zone sampling at the spots they always do it. So we have the data from that. And what's that showing is that immediately after the storm, all of their stations were extremely elevated. Most of them went down. The two stations near the beach disposal areas continue to be elevated. So we know that there are bacterial effects from the beach disposal. Santa Barbara Channel Keeper is also doing some soil testing. They actually did some sediment toxicity tests, and they found that the sediment that is being disposed does have toxicity associated with it.
And how much? When you say that there's levels, do we know what the numbers are?
I don't know what the numbers were, and I'm not even sure they told us, but I know Phil talked to Ben Peterly last week or earlier this week, and Ben told him about these numbers, and maybe they're not even official results yet. In addition, UCSB, a professor at UCSB, Dr. Holden, is doing additional sampling of sediments and water. And her emphasis is trying to determine sources. So she does the DNA marker analysis. That's going to take some time, so we won't know for sure what the sources of the bacteria are until we get those results. But that'll be interesting. It's not necessarily human. And I've talked quite a bit with Diane Gabriel, the general manager of Montecito Sanitary District, and she's very, very convinced that there was very little sewage released from her system during this event. There were some sewage lines broken, but it was 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. There's very little sewage in those lines. So it'll be interesting to see what the sources are of that fecal indicator bacteria.
And there's some DNA test that UC Santa Barbara
right.
was
that's what Dr. Holden's working on.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then the other source of sampling data I'm aware of, the fourth source, is the county sampling that we required as part of their 401 certification. So as dump trucks arrived at the two beach disposal areas, they would take samples. They didn't analyze a sample from every truck, but they composited and averaged over, I think, 10, maybe a sample for every 10 loads or so. They did grain size analysis. They did metals. They did organics. What they found, actually, was the grain size analysis was better than they were expecting. It was not as muddy and silty as they thought it might be. It was mostly sand, so that was good. The metals were clean. There was one sample that came back this week that was slightly over the sediment quality objective. And then there was nothing significant as far as organic chemicals that they ever found. So the quality wasn't that bad. The main effect appears to be bacteria and in the surf zone. So those beaches are still blocked off. You can't. There's no access to them right now.
Each truckload that was delivered to Goleta and Carpinteria were ID'd with a log track record of the origin of that particular load. So,
right.
So if there was an issue, they were actually able to trace it back to the specific location where that load came from.
So one last question for you, Harvey. How's the wastewater treatment plant doing now that we're back?
Right. So the plant itself was never affected by the mud flow. It was out of the inundation zone, so that was good news. As the mud flows occurred, there was a drop in flow. It was the middle of the night, so very, very low flow. There was actually an increase in flow over the next few hours as there was some infiltration into the collection system. And then as the water systems failed or were shut off and people evacuated, there's very little flow into their treatment system. Enough to keep it going, and they did augment it, as John mentioned earlier, with some extra organic material. They used dog food in this case just to give it some food for the biological process to keep it going. So there were never any violations of their NPDES permit at the facility. It operated throughout the incident and without any major issues.
So you may want to talk a little bit about, you know, our role initially was being facilitators, and I think you mentioned that as part of your introduction in that particular time, and then progressively, you know, the regulatory compliance aspect, but we have looked further into what other facilitation we can provide in terms of, you know, financial support through funding of Sacramento, because with the Santa Rosa FAR, Region 1 was able to get some rather quick funding support, which was for erosion control. Of course, they had the time to do it. But in this instance, erosion control is still an issue, but there is also, you know, need assessment that is being worked on, and maybe you can elaborate on that a little bit.
Well, Harvey's been working with both the Montecito Sanitary District and I think to a lesser degree flood control to assess what kind of immediate needs they might have that we might be able to assist with targeting the cleanup and abatement account as the source there.
I can expand on that a little bit too. Flood control districts' needs are immense. You know, and when we talk about using the cleanup and abatement account on an emergency basis, that's $250,000. And I read a number, they're talking about more like $110 million in trying to clean out their debris basins and channels. So I don't think we have much of a part to play with the flood control district. I have been talking to the sanitary district, and I think they would be welcome to welcome some assistance on their project, which is right now they're still videoing and cleaning sewage lines. So that's about a $900,000 contract with a outside group. But so we could help there potentially. And then also I've been talking, and we'll talk some more with State Board and UCSB about funding some of the DNA testing. She's still short of funding on that project.
And to, you know, further frame, you know, the issue, as John mentioned earlier, the scope of work performed by the flood control district represents less than 10% of the total debris cleanup that is required. So we have the elephant in the room, which is the 90-plus percent. So one of the issues, you know, that we had discussed with flood control, and say, well, you know, these debris are on private property. That's outside of our area of responsibility. However, as you saw on the maps, we do have significant amount of riparian corridor of, you know, homes being adjacent to the creeks, where we have, you know, significant erosion damage. I mean, there is no more embankment. It's gone. So, you know, some comments that were made by flood control district in some areas, for example, you know, homes don't even have a foundation, is where or not those will still be permittable, at, you know, in rebuilding at that exact location. So those are areas. But all of these riparian areas typically would require a 401 certification. So some of the thoughts is, this is strictly me speaking right now, you know, when I look at it, is, okay, we cannot have little patchwork where, you know, neighbor Smith does hire a private contractor and say, kind of fix my backyard, you know, and Mr. Jones does something else. So there has to be, you know, as typically is done with Blue Line Stream, more of a comprehensive stream restoration project that encompasses multiple landowners. So that's one part of it. So one of the thoughts that, you know, I had wearing my RCD hat, I had conversation with our Coastal Center with RCD and all, with our counterparts of the Kachuma RCD, which covers Santa Barbara. So about, what about if we have a partnering agreement, which we've done in the past because of the magnitude of the work, and possibly have a develop a master plan 401 for a whole stream and then assist landowners with the riparian restoration project. I would suspect that, you know, some of those folks, and I'm generalizing, that many of them may not critically need, you know, grant support, you know, such as, you know, EQIP. I mean, some may, but some may say, I'll write the check. I just need help to restore my, you know, the backyard of my property. So we're looking at how to leverage the RCD. We have programmatic agreements, for example, with Army Corps, Fish and Wildlife, with NOAA. So, you know, the paperwork would be a bit easier. So this was one of the thoughts, and then came the question, how to approach this? What would be the most effective way to approach this big picture is working with the Board of Supervisor of a county?
Yeah, I mean, so the first district is already underway in holding community meetings and public workshops on rebuilding efforts. And so, you know, in coordination with planning and with the first district and flood control, that would be appropriate.
But, you know, ultimately, you know, the concern is not to have, you know, and again, I'll generalize, but not say, hey, I have a backhoe, so, you know, I'll come and fix your backyard for X amount. I mean, it needs, there's certainly the social importance, but also we need to do the right thing, you know, from an environmental standpoint. So that's where the thought of having some type of collaborative agreement, which, by the way, we also thought, okay, we'll follow the California Conservation Corps in this, because the resource conservation districts, often we mobilize the seas And we'll have a team of 25 or 50 Cs working on restoration projects. So we could build the critical mass. So that, you know, just something that...
I think those are all good ideas. I think the time to engage is now, though, because there's already discussion underway and there already have been public workshops. And the watershed hasn't stopped moving, so I think some of this is premature, frankly. But I think all the more reason to get ahead of it and have a conversation about it.
So
and
maybe
be involved in that
we
process.
Can have a, you know, offline discussion and see how leveraging your, it's back to the benefiting the geography of our board members and in situation like these, you know, maximize the knowledge that you have, the network that you have, and we can have maybe a conversation to see how this alternative could be offered, because when preliminary discussion with flood control district, you know, this was like,
they're in crisis mode. So, exactly. But certainly dealing with the first district office, I think would be most effective.
Okay. Any other?
Okay. So I'm closing out that topic. You, and then I'm just going to move to the last item. Is the we received a letter, Chair Wolf and myself, from a number of parties listed and attached to the EO report item. Essentially, the request in the letter was that the current Ag Order 3.0, which is slated to expire in March 2020, be extended through to March 2022. As justification for this request, the letter cites variables and uncertainties related to Eastern San Joaquin, pending court decisions on Ag Order 2.0, anti-DEG analysis, and pending litigation on Ag Order 3.0. And I want to acknowledge these are all great points. I may have raised some of them in the past in discussions with the board. At this time, I want to recommend to the board that they not extend the order by 2 years, as recommended in the letter, acknowledging that in the foreseeable future, we'll continue to have these variables out there. Litigation will continue, very likely, with Eastern San Joaquin. I don't know anything, but I'm anticipating. And we still have to make progress. We can't hold off on action until everything settles out and certainty exists, because I think that's an unrealistic expectation, that certainty is just around the corner for us. And the issues are too compelling to not act now. We can be aware of these variables as they start to resolve and adapt accordingly, and we'll talk about them too. Eastern San Joaquin, for example, the idea of bringing a state board staff person to a not too distant board meeting, for example, helps us unpack what transpired with the new order, and thereby inform board, inform staff, and adapt. So my recommendation is, at this time, no action. And I want to reassure the board. The board still holds the ability to take an action like that suggested in the letter. I will caveat that by saying, and thereby introduce, if you were to do that, you would introduce a new level or wrinkle of complexity and potentially elicit a legal challenge. Every action has a reaction here. Okay. Questions?
Do we have any potential course of action that won't elicit a legal challenge?
No, that was totally hypothetical.
I just have one comment. I mean, I know, I don't think I was the only board member who was not thrilled that we suddenly found ourselves in the position of having to do 3.0 as for the most part, an extension of 2.0 rather than a new order. And I think that for my part, saying let's spend 3 years coming up with 4.0 was somewhat of a compromise because I had been looking for a shorter time frame. I was convinced that wasn't necessarily realistic. So, you know, it's possible that circumstances could arise that could make us change that, but I wouldn't be holding my breath.
And we're going to be transparent, we're going to need every bit of that time to get the work done that we have. It's an ambitious schedule, and not unexpectedly, challenges are popping up along the way, and we're trying to adapt to those.
Well, I mean, one area, John, that needs to be stressed is the lengthy process is not, you know, writing the order, although that's part of it, but it is to have a significant amount of outreach, communication with the various stakeholders. And one of the things that, you know, we all made a promise to ourselves is to do a lot of listening and have a lot of interaction with all the various stakeholders. And the various stakeholders are multifaceted, you know, from agriculture to, you know, commodity groups, environmental groups of various types, et cetera. So there's that big amount of time. And if you genuinely want to listen, you cannot be writing an order as you listen because it's disgenuine. So we're, you know, there's that little bit of holding off as we progress with these various outreach, which are going to be continuing. So I think, you know, when I mention that, because some say, what you folks are doing taking 3 years? Well, that's what it takes to do it right. So any comment on that? Okay. Go ahead, John.
Okay, so that, I believe that's all I have.
So I have three speaker card. We'll take Abby, then we'll take, no, you're done? Okay. Kay is left, and, last but not least, but it says, yes, exactly. Thank you. All right. Well, thank you very much. Yes, go ahead.
Just as a point of a final statement for the day today, across the hearing items, I really want to recognize Monica Baracate for her part this morning. Recognizing that we struggle to have the resources to deal with our bilingual community, and I think we're very fortunate to have your technical skill set, you know, in a bilingual setting, and I don't want to overlook it or take it for granted. I know how hard it is to translate, and I think the individuals who were here today, and apparently, you know, it took a lot for them to finally feel that they could engage with us after three NOVs, and clearly there's communication difficulties, understanding, and so forth. So I'm sure that your involvement made a huge difference for them today. So I want to thank you for that.
Right, so if we don't have any further comment, I will then officially adjourn our February 9th, 2018 Central Coast Regional Water Quality Control Board meeting, and it is 3:36 in the afternoon. So thank you very much. Meeting adjourned.